Branding is a perfect word for it. It's intended to constrict political dialogue, to set the parameters of allowable thought and to say, you can use this term, which happens to express, and it's loaded with our political bias in the term, but you cannot use a more accurate term. Of course, the legal term is illegal alien, so something that would be even more out of favor yet. But the idea between the term illegal immigrant shows that the immigration is illegal, that the underlying action is against the law.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to Outstanding, where we have critical conversations about the news of the day and the ideas that shape us. Once again, I'm your host, Joseph Backholm. It's my pleasure to be with you today. Our goal in every episode is to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. How do we think about the world the way he wants us to? Today, we're going to try to do that and try to understand how to think biblically about the battle over language. Now, in the formal debate world, which is part of my background, I once did formal Lincoln-Douglas debate and CX debate, and I will say, as an aside, that if you have a young person in your life who is considering whether to be involved in formal debate, you should encourage them to do so. There's literally no skill that I know of that is more applicable to every area of life than the ability to confidently and effectively make an argument. So if they're thinking about it, encourage them to do it. Even if they're not thinking about it, still encourage them to do it, because they will benefit from it for sure. But in the formal debate world, there's an old saying that he who defines the terms wins the debate. Now, what this means is that if you can get the audience to accept what you mean by the definition of a word, you are very likely to win the debate on the merits. Now, let's give you some examples of how this is working in the real world today. What is love? How do we define that term? Now, I would argue that one of, if not the primary reason the sexual revolution has made so much progress is because it has convinced tens of millions of people that the definition of the word love is celebrate anything someone wants to do. So conversely, the definition of the term hate is not bitterness or anger or some kind of desire for revenge, but simply disagreement with someone's choices or beliefs. We see the same thing around the term racism. Does the term racism require bad intentions or, as many argue today, simply inequitable outcomes on something like an SAT test? Now, sometimes the war over words gets really silly. We saw that recently in a backlash against President Trump for his use of the term bloodbath. He received much of that backlash from people who had long tolerated the use and, in fact, used the term bloodbath themselves, but suddenly it was outrageous. We see something similar with the term Christian nationalism. We can't seem to agree on what that means. Is it civic stewardship, which many claim as a good thing, or is it a threat to democracy, which of course many claim as a bad thing? This is very effective in the debate over abortion. Abortion is now referred to somewhat euphemistically as women's health care or abortion care. We just throw the term care on the end of it and suddenly it's a virtuous thing, right? That's supposed to make it better. The term woke was something that the left coined for themselves. Now the right uses it as a pejorative. There's certainly this debate over whether wokeness is a good thing or a bad thing. And depending on your political tribe, that has a lot to say about how you affect or how you think about the answer to that question. Now, with that context, is all of this an effort to create a kinder, gentler world? Or is this war over words an effort to obfuscate or hide the truth or win political battles, or is it some combination of the two of those things? Joining me now to discuss all of it is Ben Johnson. He's a senior reporter at the Washington Stand who's written a great article related to this topic called A Bloodbath of Journalistic Ethics, and you should check that out immediately at washingtonstand.com. Ben, thanks for coming on today.
Good to be with you, Joseph.
Well, given that intro, there's a lot to kind of cover in this general war over words, but I want to start with the article that you've written about bloodbath. And I think a lot of people might be familiar with the story, but to quickly catch us up on kind of the silliness, but also the seriousness of kind of what happened in that story.
Yeah, the silliness is it was a completely offhanded term used by President Donald Trump. He was campaigning in my home state of Ohio for Bernie Moreno, who ended up winning the primary. And he was talking about the electric vehicle industry. So he said China for many years has used our agreement with Mexico to send parts to Mexico and then bring them into the U.S. market without any tariffs due to NAFTA. So he was talking about the fact that there was a major expansion into the Mexican market by a Chinese EV maker. And he said, if I'm elected, we're going to have a 100% tariff on these vehicles. If I'm not elected, there'll be a bloodbath. And bloodbath is an economic term, meaning a major economic downturn. It's used by the financial press all the time. Matter of fact, one of the most funny parts of this is that after this went viral, people simply cut out the word bloodbath. He said, there's going to be a bloodbath if I'm not elected. And that became the headline. It began, of course, with the DNC, with the Biden campaign putting out a press release, just drawing attention to this disembodied word by itself and saying there will be a bloodbath if I'm not elected. Suddenly, that became all that anyone saw on the media all weekend. Went on, sometimes doubling and tripling down the case of Joe in Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough. He led with it two mornings in a row after the genie was out of the bottle and everyone had seen the full clip. So they said, President Trump says there will be a bloodbath if I'm not elected. So they took it completely out of context. Instead of saying there will be an economic downturn, as we saw for two quarters under Biden already, which most people refer to as a recession, but officially no one does. He said, instead of saying that, that there's going to be some kind of a civil war if he's not the next president of the United States in Grover Cleveland fashion.
Well, and you just stated it there, but it's worth stating the obvious. Why were they so interested in taking this out of context, Ben? Elaborate on that a bit more.
Well, then they can tie it to January 6th and say that this was being a form of incitement for another January 6th or a worse version of this. It was a kind of a form of domestic terrorism. And the current campaign in the DNC is basically to emphasize abortion and, quote unquote, the threat to our democracy. So anything that says, if I'm not elected, there will be some kind of violent backlash feeds into that narrative, which they're trying to establish. And the media generally played into this. Joe Scarborough, it's funny, there's a multiple minute long clip of Scarborough using the term bloodbath over and over again himself. Obviously, he was not calling for violence, but this is a standard, very simple term, and it's simply taken completely out of context, placed into a different narrative, and then used in order to discredit the person who said it.
Yeah. Well, there certainly is a context for Trump's use of the term bloodbath, and we all understand bloodbath. It does have another reference because, I mean, a bloodbath is a very violent war, and you know, and we can understand kind of the gruesome, gory context, but that has been borrowed and applied to all sorts of other contexts. And people have, I mean, people have used that not only in an economic context, as you described. That's been described, you know, that term has been used in an athletic context, in a sports event that was not particularly competitive or close, just to refer to the fact that one side just destroyed the other side. So we get that. But as we zoom out from this particular example, I think really what it illustrates is that in this context, and just kind of in use of language, people are not always interested in representing the truth of the matter. And, you know, we all know Trump has his critics. Certainly Joe Biden has his critics. And even before Joe Biden or Donald Trump were on the American political scene, there were political campaigns. And we have seen negative ads for generations. And isn't part of what those negative ads do is omit relevant information, take things, I mean, he actually said there's going to be a bloodbath, right? So those words, if you have no context, oh, that's terrible. I mean, he's inciting violence, right? And this is by far not the first time this kind of trick has been played, but the desire and the intent is to create a false representation of what actually happened. And is this, largely a function of people who just are not interested in truth. They're interested in victory.
It is in some cases forthrightly. One of them, whom I cite in my article, Anna Marie Cox of The New Republic, was on MSNBC, and she said, this is a quotation, we can't look at what he's saying and think, oh, well, we're going to be accurate for this. So, she goes on to say he was speaking about the auto industry. But the truth is so important, as Winston Churchill said, you should always send it with a large contingent of lies as guards, right? So that's essentially what's being said here, is that the narrative is so important that anything that reinforces the narrative has to be the lead, and anything that would interfere with that has to be stripped away. There was a gentleman who is at the College of William and Mary. I was talking about NPR for conservative media, and he was talking about conservative media stories. He said, if you stripped enough context away, any piece of truth can become a piece of misinformation. Now, he was talking about the liberal narrative that goes along with these issues, because conservatives don't present the narrative you find everywhere else. But he's what his words themselves, stripping them of their context, really do apply to this story. That sometimes people simply wish to misrepresent something, so they wrench a word out of context. It's been done many, many times. It's a dirty trick, and it shouldn't be done. But we would expect that from, say, a 30-second political spot or something. We would expect that from either party, and both parties do it, certainly. Every candidate who's running for office has probably done it. But we don't expect it from people who are supposedly the guardians of truth in the media, telling us what we should think about these issues and promising us that if we don't listen to them, democracy will die in the dark.
And that raises a really important point here, that if any of us are continuing under the illusion that all of these corporate media entities are just dying to present you reality as best they can, we need to disabuse ourselves of that, because this is just exhibit number, 9,845 of the fact that for the most part, all of these media companies, the corporate ones, are activists for the left. And so understanding that, it doesn't mean everything that they say is false, but we have to understand that there's not this abiding underlying commitment to the truth. And that should make us discerning consumers. And I think that quote that you said there is really powerful, that stripped of its context, any piece of truth can be a piece of disinformation. And I might be misquoting you, but that's essentially what you said. And I hadn't heard that quote, but that's a really important thing to remember. But we, as believers, I mean, there's a couple things that we have to think about here, because this should affect not only how we consume information, so we do so with a healthy, if not joyful, kind of skepticism, right? I don't think we need to be angry and cynical about everything. We just need to understand human nature. And there are a lot of people who have already decided, this is the story I want you to believe. And no matter what the facts are, that's what I'm going to try to convince you of. But also our own abilities to fall into this trap of tribalism, of bias, of some kind of prejudice. And of course, I don't mean that in a racial sense. I just mean that in a, I really like you, so everything you do is good, or I really dislike you, so everything that you do is bad. Ben, how do we know, do you think, and I'm going to, maybe have you put on your pastoral hat for this one. How do we know if we are pursuing a situation, trying to understand the truth of the matter, or if we are actually just trying to be partisans and hide the truth that we find inconvenient?
Well, it's funny that you raised that, because one of the things that came to me, if someone came to me in pastoral counseling and showed me the Donald Trump clip and then showed me the way that this was presented in the media and said, I did that, my first thought would be, this person is so full of hatred for another person that it's spiritually unhealthy for someone to misrepresent things in this way, because you obviously have decided everything that person does is bad. And you're just filled with such a passionate hatred that they could say, I love children, and you'd accuse them of pedophilia. Anything that they say would be negative. So you cannot have that kind of an idea and be a Christian or someone who is attempting to walk in the path of even basic human decency. I would tell people, if you really want to know whether something's true, first of all, try to find primary sources. Try to find the full context, the full clip, the full video. We saw how important this was in the Nick Sandman case, where he was accused of provoking the confrontation. Later on, we found out it was the exact opposite. So try to find original sources, and then ask yourself this question. If the facts were reversed, on this, and I heard this about my favorite politician. Would I believe it? If not, what would I do next?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you present it that way. Donald Trump is far from my favorite politician. But when I saw the headline, the first time I came across this story, it was probably on Twitter or something. And it said, you know, Trump says there's going to be a bloodbath if he's not elected. And my immediate instinctive reaction was, no, he didn't. And I don't even remember who had the headline, but I'm just so accustomed now to kind of this, the Trump derangement syndrome. And I do believe there are versions of Trump derangement syndrome on the left and the right. There are people who hate him so much they cannot think clearly about him. And there are people who love him so much they cannot think clearly about him. And so it's an equally problematic virus, regardless of which version of it you have. But I was so confident that he did not actually say what the headline was saying he had said that I just kind of didn't even investigate it for a while. And eventually I'd run across it a bunch of times and I realized, yeah, here's the real context of this. But Ben, what is the impact of a media enterprise that has done that to me? Essentially, and I know I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one who looks at that stuff and is like, yeah, whatever. I don't believe anything that you say. What does that mean for our institutions and our ability to have dialogue and kind of address public issues?
Well, unfortunately, the Washington Post slogan, which I quoted earlier, really is true. We need information in order to be successful citizens, in order to make decent decisions, informed decisions about what candidates to support, how to take a position on an issue. We need to have the underlying context and information that's available for us. And when someone massages the meaning of things or distorts the meaning of things, that's where we begin to lose our ability to act intelligently as citizens. And ultimately, I think that is really the import of what's happening here. When people change these ideas, they do so for a couple of different reasons. The most important one is literally to suppress thought. To keep us from being able to have certain kinds of thoughts because we don't have the language to express it. We don't have the information to push back and say, yes, he said it was a bloodbath, but actually that's an economic term and it was taken out of context. He was talking about the auto industry. We don't have that ability. I guess most people probably recognize that idea from 1984, but George Orwell wrote a wonderful essay about 3 years before 1984 called Politics in the English Language. And one of the things that he wrote in there I thought was so applicable, I wanted to quote it here on the podcast. He said, a man may take to drink because he feels himself to be a failure and then fail all the more completely because he drinks. It's rather the same thing that's happening to the English language. It becomes ugly and inarticulate because our thoughts are foolish, but the slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. So it's a mutually reinforcing process here. We're not able to express ourselves clearly and we end up thinking indistinctly and vice versa. The two are completely reinforcing one another. Yeah. In many cases, it is purely political. It's just to put the other side on the defensive. The old saying is, if you're explaining, you're losing. So you have to say, well, I'm not really a genocidal Nazi. I just don't believe in open borders. Yeah. And so, yeah, and the next thing you know, you're carried off on this monologue that is going nowhere. And part of it, I think, is really a power play on the other side. You end up showing everyone that you're setting the agenda. So you can say if Donald Trump uses the word bloodbath or if someone on the other side uses a word that you can wrench out of context. I remember it happened to a Senate candidate who was saying that he was opposed to killing children who were conceived through rape. And they wrenched some of his words out of context to say that God intended the rape to happen. This happened a few years ago. So if you are engaging in that, you're showing that I set the agenda. It doesn't matter what the facts are. My allegations are the most important thing. They're the only thing worth covering.
Yeah. When it comes to the sloppiness of our language, I think sometimes that's purposeful. And I want to refer to another recent example when President Biden apologized after the State of the Union for his use of the term illegal immigrant. And it was a moment where he kind of went off teleprompter because he was having an impromptu kind of back and forth with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was heckling him from the audience over the murder of Lincoln Riley in that situation. And he referred to her killer as an illegal immigrant. And after that speech, went on MSNBC and apologized for having said that, and said at that time that he should have used the term undocumented. Undocumented person is now the favored term, and illegal immigrant has fallen out of favor. But there's something interesting about those choices of terms, because Lake and Riley's killer was not undocumented. He, in fact, had been documented twice to be present in the country illegally. And the term illegal immigrant is a much more precise, more accurate term. And so this seems to me to be an example of we're having a war over words, and we're going to create public pressure to, like was created, I mean, if they can do this to the president of the United States, they can do this to anybody, right? President Biden, you must apologize because you've used this term that we, whoever we are, have determined is not appropriate. And I think the reason it is out of favor is because the left's position on immigration is anybody should be able to come anytime they want, and we should just be fine with that. And by highlighting the fact that it's illegal, that, of course, kind of prejudices the event that they're trying to celebrate, because it's breaking, it's unlawful, right? And so they want to minimize that. So how much of this is not just sloppiness, but it's actually intentional misrepresentation of the facts, because we don't want people to know the truth. Therefore, we don't want to be communicating the truth of the matter. So we're going to kind of, you know, it's a branding exercise, essentially.
Branding is a perfect word for it. It's intended to constrict political dialogue, to set the parameters of allowable thought, and to say, you can use this term, which happens to express, and it's loaded with our political bias in the term, but you cannot use a more accurate term. Of course, the legal term is illegal alien, even. So something that would be even more out of favor yet. But the idea between the term illegal immigrant shows that the immigration is illegal, that the underlying action is against the law. Even if most Americans say would not want to deport every single illegal immigrant in the country, which I think most polling would show, that still it underlines the fact that anything that takes place outside of a deportation is an act of mercy, because of the fact that illegal immigration is by its nature illegal. So that's in the normal term, the normal terminology, which the president's not allowed to use anymore. Undocumented, they're deliberately pushing him to this term, because undocumented, everyone, that's a term everyone has been at some point. Everyone's left for the grocery store and left their wallet at home. They don't have their driver's license. I'm undocumented. So obviously, there's a lot of moral difference between that and MS-13 or Hamas crossing the southern border. But that's what they're trying to do, is to conflate all of these things into, there's no difference between legal and illegal. There's no difference between an American and someone who is not an American. Anyone who is in this country deserves political representation by any chosen member of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Let me provide one other example of where this is happening within the current administration. And this is a report from the Daily Wire a handful of days ago. The intelligence called the Dive, and exclusively obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by the Daily Wire, argues in its cover story that the intelligence community needs to focus on, quote, changing terminology related to counterterrorism because, quote, words matter, end quote. Now, I'm going to quote from this memo here to illustrate another point. This article is about one of our goals: disentangling Islam from words and phrases used to discuss terrorism and extremist violence, writes the author of the article, whose name was redacted. The article declares that it's trying to remove, quote, certain phrases to identify international terrorism threats that are hurtful to Muslim Americans. And then it goes on to list, these include terms like jihadist, jihadi, Muslim extremist, things of that nature. So we see this other example where we are going to, I mean, and there's just no question that Muslim terrorism is specifically connected to this ideology. Now, granted, we understand that most Muslims are not terrorists, and we're thankful for that, of course. But there is an indisputable connection between a certain theological branch of Islam and Islamic terrorism that we are going to say we can't talk about. Now, that. And then we just made the example of what's happening at the border. One other example of this war over words that we're probably most familiar with, that has been the most contentious, is pronouns. And this idea that you cannot say that a man is a man if the man says he is a woman. Even though, you know, the chromosomes aren't changed, the anatomy is what it is, the biology is what it is. So we have pronouns, we have immigration policy, we have how do we refer to terrorism. How important of it is it, given the pressure being applied in different contexts, not to say the thing that is obviously true? Does that make it more important that we say the thing that is obviously true?
It absolutely does. When you hear about these ideas that we're going to constrict language, that we're not going to tie, for example, Islam to terrorism, even though, as you say, there's a certain brand of Islam, Wahhabi Islam, that inherently says we need to establish a worldwide caliphate. Everyone must abide by Sharia law and violence is okay. We have a fatwa saying that you may use violent ends, including self-immolation, in order to carry that forth. There is no Christian analog to that. However, while the same that administration is disentangling Islam and terrorism, they are conjoining Christian nationalism, sometimes together with terrorism. By the way, also conjoining the word white Christian nationalism in there, which I find incredibly offensive for my multiracial congregation, probably yours as well, you know, for the multiracial body of Christ in general. So right. Obviously, some people are more important than others, but what it brought to mind for me is they're defining essentially words that are unspeakable. Unspeakable words like Islamic terrorism or biological male, things of that sort, when talking about transgenderism. What that makes me think of is the Torah, and particularly the unspeakable name of God, Yahweh, that only the high priest could speak that word once a year on the Day of Atonement in the Holy of Holies, and only if he was properly spiritually disposed, otherwise he'd die. They'd have to yank him out, put another high priest in order to complete the Rite of Atonement. So there are certain words that are so holy, they can only be spoken by a certain class, and you can't put them in your mouth. And so the idea of Islam is holy now. This has been the position since at least the Obama administration, that Islam is a religion without any ties to terrorism, that America is not a Christian nation, but we are one of the largest Muslim nations in the world by population. Barack Obama said that at one point. So it's that kind of an idea that nothing negative can be associated with Islam, even when it is accurate. You can say, as we do, perhaps, that that's one branch of Islam. It's certainly a minority of Islamic believers, but nonetheless, they are inspired by a version of Islam, and we should speak that forthrightly. The idea that someone identifies as a different gender and you can't, quote unquote, dead name them or use, in quote unquote, inappropriate pronouns, which are accurate, says that their self-identity is more holy than your right to speak the truth. And that's why we have to speak the truth over and over again. The more that they tell you don't say it, say it.
Yeah, and you refer there to the Ministry of Truth. And for those who have not read 1984, it just comes to life more every day because there's all these departments within the government inside 1984. They have the Ministry of Truth, which is, of course, the propaganda arm of the government. They have the Ministry of Peace, which is, of course, the War Department. And then they have the Ministry of Love, which is basically the prison system where they take all the political prisoners and put them away. And then they have the Ministry of Plenty, which rations all the limited resources they have. So everything in 1984 in that world means the opposite of what the words originally would be intended to communicate. And we see how we're kind of walking down this road where you can't say illegal immigrant, you can't say Islamic terrorist, you can't say a man is a man, right? So the words that they want you to use actually mean the opposite of what they really should mean. So we're just crawling our way, maybe even we're sprinting our way there. But I'm going to assume, Ben, that you've read Rod Dreher's book, Live Not by Lies.
I actually have not. I'm sorry.
You have not. Okay. Well, it's a good one. You should at some point, and actually the rest of our audience, I'll commend this to them as well. But this is a fundamental point because because what he does in that book is he interviews a bunch of families who managed to disciple Christian families inside the Iron Curtain. And what was life like as faithful Christians inside the Iron Curtain? Were you able to pass that faith on and maintain your convictions and your commitment to God in a world that punished it? And one of the theses of that book is never say things you know not to be true. And the moment that you do, that you say something because there's tremendous political, governmental, even legal pressure to say something or just imply, and that's what a lot of this is happening, we're not going to say the truth of the matter because there's a consequence for it. Once you do that, you've sold your soul, essentially, is what he's talking. And the key thing that they would do is they didn't always speak the complete truth of the matter, but you cannot say things that are not, that you know not to be true, even though there will be tremendous pressure to do so. Because if you do, you no longer belong to yourself. And in 1984 terms, you know, Big Brother has you where he wants you.
Well, that's certainly true. And I've been blessed to be able to speak with people who grew up behind the Iron Curtain and had that very experience, people who had to bury Bibles so that they could keep them in the family because the Soviets would confiscate them and destroy them. And Rod Dreher has done a wonderful job from what excerpts I've read of the book, but I've never read the full thing. What excerpts I've read and the familiarity that I have with that book, he's done a splendid job of saying what has happened and giving us kind of an example of how we might have to react someday soon in the future. What came to mind for me, the head of the Coptic Church, who died several years ago, Shenouda III, he was being asked about the president of Egypt who had died, Hosni Mubarak. And they asked him, where do you believe he is? Do you believe he's in heaven or in hell? And he said, he is with his prophet and his God. you have to be very careful when you're 10% of the population in an area controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of answers that perhaps we might have to give with a bit of shading. But people in some situations can't speak forth, their jobs could be on the line, their security could be on the line, and so forth. But there is another book that says that we cannot tell lies no matter what's at stake. So the minute you begin to do that, not only have you sold your soul to the system, but internally speaking, as a pastor putting that other hat on, any sin that we commit ultimately unleashes the powers of evil throughout the system. Any one sin will undermine our ability to withhold ourselves from any other sin. So people will often say, you know, I'm having so many issues with this, and you find out that they've been committing some other sin. If you attack that sin, suddenly you'll be stronger the entire way around as well. So it's a wonderful way to take out one brick of the spiritual edifice and deplete your spiritual energy if you begin to participate in these kinds of nonsensical word games.
Compromise begets compromise, and courage begets courage. You're never standing still. You're moving either in a good direction or a bad direction at all times. That's a really good exhortation as well. So, you know, I don't know how to summarize this because there's so many pieces to it. But, you know, when it comes to this understanding of just how we're being manipulated and being healthily skeptical consumers, if that's the right term, of the information that we intake, especially in an election year, right? That's what 2024, this is just going to all be about, eliminating context to create false impressions because the communicator benefits if they can mislead you in some way. So just being wise when it comes to consuming that information and not just allowing confirmation bias to be our guide, which is I want that to be true, therefore I will just tell myself it is true and just not ask any critical questions. But also making sure that we are not falling into this trap in our own lives where we are afraid to say the unvarnished truth, where we get upset at people for saying things that are true because, you know, it makes me uncomfortable. Now, there's a difference, of course, between speaking with grace and kindness, and you can say true and right things in ways that are edifying and encouraging, or in ways that are that will tear down, because life and death is in the power of the tongue. And so this is not, I hope it's not received as license to just be terrible to people. And that's not at all what we're intending to communicate here. But the use of our words matters, and we need to know if we are using them because we love the truth or because we're afraid of the truth. And that's ultimately something that only we and the Holy Spirit know for sure, but we should care, and hopefully he will convict us of that. So Ben, it's a conversation that will be endless, it seems. It's going to go on for a long time as we try to navigate this. And I thank you for your wisdom and your time and your work on this.
Well, thank you so much for your excellent work and illuminating some of the words that we're allowed to use and not allowed to use. And hopefully over the many years to come, we'll continue speaking the unspeakable word.
That's right. And we will live not by lies. Don't say not true things, friends. Thank you for joining us in this conversation today. If you've enjoyed it, share it with a friend because they will as well. Make sure you like and subscribe wherever you have found us. New episodes are released every Tuesday and Friday. You don't want to miss them. Also, if you have any comments, questions, feedback for me, love hearing from you, email me at outstanding@washingtonstand.com. Enjoyed my time. Looking forward to the next one. My name is Joseph Fackel, and this has been Outstanding.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.